You ready to proceed? Before you do, let me welcome on behalf of the court our visiting counsel and our other visitors today. We hope you enjoy the arguments. You're fortunate in that you're going to have very good lawyers at the arguments this morning, which should make it even more informative than on an ordinary day. With that, let's proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, good morning. I would like to think that the audience here was because of this argument, but I think Mr. Wallace, who's in attendance, is charging or scalping tickets out there to get these folks to come in today, and I think he's making a profit. I hope in his argument the court questions him on that, because I think it may be some propriety issues. This is a case which, as the court has seen, in its nature, is very simple. The issue, though, actually arises in a context of where there have been, I would represent to the court, substantial changes in the role and function of probation officers, and in the process. And I can simply share with the court that over a number of years' experience in dealing with probation officers and their function and role, there has been a substantial transformation over the past decade or so, and it seems to be picking up speed. We have governor's task force. We have given probation officers sidearms. We have jump-out squads. We have probation officers who are solicited to assist the police in a quasi-police function role, and the appellant's position here is that this has morphed into a situation where the probation officer is now almost, in many contexts, a police official himself, notwithstanding the fact that he or she may not have that authority, may not be trained in that role. And I think this case is generated from that context. This is a case where the police could have certainly obtained a warrant to search for a weapon in a vehicle. Obviously, the establishment of probable cause is always a subjective evaluation. The trial judge in this case, who was not the trial judge, the judge presiding over the suppression hearing, said as an intellectual curiosity, what did the state think as far as whether there was sufficient PC in that case to get a warrant? It was quite obvious in that context. The judge says, well, there seems to be sufficient information here that was corroborated by the woman in question who was providing information to the police, that they could have gotten a warrant, but they decided not to get a warrant. They decided instead that they were going to call probation and parole, and to expedite this or to make it easier for them, and I hate to use the term shortcut, but to shortcut the system, and they solicited the probation office. Luckily, there were supervisors there for them in the daytime.
Why would they need a warrant for a motor vehicle given its mobility?
Well, I don't think this was a search incident to an arrest at that time. They didn't have, I don't think they had grounds other than to get a search warrant to go into the vehicle. And he was not charged with anything at that time because they had approached him because a misdemeanor allegedly had been committed outside their presence. And the police talked to him on the street, went back to the woman who had made a complaint against him, and indicated at that time that there was a weapon, and he had a weapon in his car. At least that was what her thought was at the time. So I think the question for them was, although there was sufficient probable cause to get into that car, I think their decision was that they were going to get a probation officer to come over to make this a probation situation, and they therefore could effectuate a search of the car and a seizure of any contraband in the car. The bottom line in these kinds of cases is that certainly, assuming that a warrant could have been obtained, it takes time. And those of us who have been in the system a long time know that police, like everybody else, don't want to go to a magistrate, don't want to draft a probable cause sheet, don't want to take that time. And there are some benefits to this. There are some benefits, and I'm sure the state will be able to point those out. It saves time. It's probably a good use of resources because the probation office has information which they can share with the police officers. But in this case, this was not a combined governor's task force or jump out squad or other probation kind of a situation. It became one at some point When the phone call is made to the probation office, and the probation office takes that phone call, and as the officer testified at suppression, why did you make the phone call? We knew that they could get into the car.
Well, does the record show that the probation officer conducted his own investigation?
It does to an extent, and they, there can be at least in part a compelling argument that when the officer got to the scene, and it was an experienced probation officer, when he got to the scene, he had already talked with his supervisors about this, which is consistent with the protocol. But when he had left the probation office, I would submit that he was well aware, as were they, that this was going to be a search of this vehicle. He got to the scene. His report was that the individual in question appeared nervous and was sweating at the time. He did ask two things that I recall. He asked one, do you want to make this easy or make this hard? Which to me echoes that this is a police officer's function. This is not a supervisory probation officer's function. But that's the mentality that now is being imbued into their responsibilities. He says, you want to make this easy, you want to make this hard. The appellant had already decided that the police were not going to get a consent to be given his consent to search the car. He then decided to make that statement. He also, at the hearing, went on record saying he appeared nervous and didn't answer the question. Because I asked him, was there a weapon in the car? And he did not answer the question. He further said that for a number of months, I forget the exact number of months now in the transcript, a number of months he had dealt with this individual. He thought that that was suspicious. He did not respond. But he also acknowledged he had had no problems with him as a probationer during that period of time. As a result of that, he goes into the car and finds the weapon in question.
And do you agree that the probation officer had reasonable grounds to conduct the search?
I would say that there probably was a reasonable, articulable suspicion that if the information had been conveyed to him through his supervisors, that he probably at that point would have had the authority to go in. My question is,
is this about the police making a phone call to the wrong person?
No.
That is, if the supervisor gets called and the police tell the supervisor the same thing that they told this police officer, this probation officer, and then the supervisor tells that information to the investigating probation officer, that's okay. But if the phone call is made directly to the probation officer, that's not okay?
No, I don't think that is not the point I was trying to make. The point I'm trying to make is the police decided that they were going to circumvent the need to obtain a warrant in this case and put a phone call into the probation office to get some representative of that office to be dispatched out to the street so that this car could be searched.
Well, whether the police decided to circumvent getting a warrant or not, would not matter if there was a lawful contact of and search by the probation people, isn't that right?
If the argument could be made that he had developed a sufficient, reasonable, articulable suspicion independently, I would submit of that.
What do you mean independently?
The question is,
what was this probation officer supposed to do? He receives a phone call from the police. After the police give him information that they got from the victim, is the probation officer supposed to say, oh, no, I can't do anything because I received the call from you, and I'm afraid that, I'm going to be viewed as a stalking horse?
Well, that's the gravamen of my argument.
Suppose that the information that the probation officer got is valid information that creates a reasonable suspicion that would create cause to search. What then?
I would say under the circumstances that person who is there with that information with a reasonable articulable suspicion has a right to go into that vehicle. My concern is that as the fourth item on the list of protocols that the Department of Corrections has established says, you are not basically going to do this. You are not to conduct searches at the direction of a law enforcement agency.
What do you mean at the direction of? That is, what is it in this case that, in your view, made the search at the direction of, as opposed to independently, but based on information supplied by law enforcement agencies?
The fact that the police officer said under oath that the reason I made the call to probation was because they could get into the car.
Well, that may be what was going on inside the mind of the police officer, but how does that internal thought make whatever the probation people did at the direction of?
Well, the case law, and Your Honor just mentioned Stalking Horse, the case law suggests that there are concerns by courts where courts say that probation officers should not be lackeys or stalking horses to law enforcement officials.
Right. And this probation officer received a phone call that went as follows, policeman, we want you to come out here and search the car. I'll be happy to give you reasons. And at which point the probation officer says, oh, no, you need not say any more. I'll go out just in your word alone. That might be at the direction of. Did that happen here?
No. It did not. When the police contacted the probation office, the police, I don't know how much information was conveyed at that time. That line of questioning, and I didn't handle that, but that line of questioning was designed, I think, to try to determine if there had been communication with supervisors in the probation office, and there is a requirement in the Department of Corrections protocol that supervisors somehow have got to be involved in this. And as an aside, let me give the court an example of a case. I have a case where there is there was an arrest conducted on a warrant, and the individual in question who had been arrested was asked to step from the residence. The resident stepped outside. He was arrested on the outstanding warrant. The police took with them a probation officer, and he had been on probation, and took a probation officer along. And they then, as a basis of that, although it is a stretch for search incident to arrest, they searched the entire residence, went back inside, searched his residence, and then went to additional vehicles, some of which were at the scene and some were not at the scene, went to additional vehicles and searched those individual vehicles and property that he owned as a result of being a probationer who was now arrested. The police never considered to go to a court and get a search warrant to do that, but they effectuated individual searches of other outbuildings and other locations where these vehicles were located because they had a probation officer in attendance. That officer, under those circumstances, this was not a probation investigation per se. Obviously, there's some relationship because he's on probation, but this was a situation where the probation officer accompanied the police in a police capacity to execute a warrant, and because he was in attendance, they searched all these various locales.
But that's not this case, is it?
No, it's not this case.
Mr. Letang, let's go back just for a moment in time to when the people that established both the U.S. and the Delaware Constitution believed that it was important to protect the person in the street from unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. Do you have case law that suggests that the facts here constitute an unreasonable search and seizure?
I do not have that here in this particular case. The reasonableness obviously is the key. This argument is more of an argument directed at the fact that probation officers are in this context being used as surrogate police officers, and that is not their role and function. At least traditionally has not been their role and function, and maybe this court wants to say that's fine, they can do that, but it is not historically the role and function of a police officer, whether the case law says they're part of the judiciary or they're not sworn to those.
No, I understand that, but it would be helpful at least to me to know that if that's the role that they're playing today under the factual circumstances of this case, that it's A, something different than the police asking a civilian to go up to the car and ask the driver whether or not he has a gun in the car, and then the civilian comes back and reports that to the police, or the civilian sees the gun and reports that he's seen the gun, and then the police go and sees the guy. And then it's pretty clear that the police have used him as an agent.
Right.
In this case, let's assume the police are using probation officers as an agent to do what they otherwise could not have done in order to avoid the impracticality in their minds or the annoyance of having, God forbid, go and get a warrant before they stop somebody and want to search their car. What's the constitutional protection, if any, from that, given the current state of the case law, either under federal law in the United States Constitution, or is there any case law under the Delaware Constitution?
I'm not aware of that.
Okay. Thank you. In your rebuttal, do you want to?
I'll reserve time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, James Wakely on the behalf of the State of Delaware. With all due respect to my learned opponent, he would have you believe that what happened here was Mr. Everett had done nothing. He was hanging out by his car. The police received a call from Ms. Colazzo that Mr. Everett had punched her or hit her in some way. They talked to Mr. Everett. Mr. Everett said he didn't want them to search the car. They called the probation office. Probation said, sure, I'll come right out. Came right out, searched the car, I found the gun. It's simply not the factual circumstance here. We had a report of a domestic incident that was reported to probation and parole, and quite frankly, the only...
Who reported it to probation and parole?
It was reported by the police. It was...
Why?
Because once the... police determined that Mr. Everett was on probation status, as this court found in Miller, this case transitioned to a probation matter and no longer a police matter.
That very fact makes it a probation matter, the fact that he's on probation?
I believe that would be a reasonable interpretation of Miller, Your Honor.
Mr. Letang suggesting to us that the in the real world, what happens is it's like, aha, he's on probation. Now we don't have to go through the usual rigmarole that we find so annoying, which is to go to a magistrate and ask for a search warrant. We can now get a probation officer to do what we cannot do, therefore making the police officer our surrogate or our agent, or the probation officer our surrogate or agent. So the probation officer has greater flexibility in asking questions of a prospective defendant and in searching his automobile or his home or any outbuildings connected with that home. The police have found great utility in that, and that it's simply a sham to get around the constitutional requirement that they ought to get a search warrant before, without probable cause otherwise, or because a crime hasn't been committed in their presence, they need to establish probable cause for a warrant. They can avoid that simply by the aha, gotcha, you're on probation. And he suggests there's something wrong with that. Is there or isn't there?
I would suggest if the system was not functioning the way it was, that if the probation office simply was a rubber stamp committee, sent somebody out to search the car, then perhaps we would have a problem there.
Why would it be a problem?
Well, the role of the probation officer, as Mr. Letang suggested, is not that of a police officer. The role of the probation officer is to enforce the rules of probation. And consistent with that duty and with the lower expectation of privacy enjoyed by probationers, the probation officer still has to do some investigation to determine if he has his own reasonable suspicion that some violation is occurring. And I think that's what happened here. We have a circumstance where...
Well, the disconnect here, at least intellectually, is that obviously enough, the complainant didn't call the probation office and say, your probationer just struck me and has a gun, what are you going to do about it? He's on probation, and then the probation officer went out and did something about it, acting as a probation officer. Instead, the complainant logically called the police, then the police find out that the prospective defendant's on probation. Instead of going and doing what police officers do under those circumstances, go and get a warrant based on the information given to them about a crime that did not occur in their presence, instead they call the probation officer. And the probation officer conducts the search they could not otherwise conduct without a warrant, arguably. is there something wrong with that?
With all due respect, Your Honor, the state would submit that the intent of the police officer is largely irrelevant. It is the question of once they contact probation and parole, the probation officer has to do an independent determination if reasonable suspicion exists to search the vehicle.
Does it matter what the police tell the probation officer? I mean, can they, even if the police just call up the probation officer and say, get out here, you know, we think there may be a problem, nothing more.
If the probation officer then goes out there and searches based entirely on that comment, I would suggest that there would be a problem.
All right.
The probation officer did not do his own independent investigation in that case.
Okay, what was communicated here?
From what the state can determine from the record, the police communicated to the probation officer that there was a domestic incident and that the girlfriend or friend, Ms. Colazzo, reported that there was a firearm in Mr. Everett's vehicle. When the probation officer got out there and before
you get to that point, would that fact, if it was a fact, constitute a probation violation?
Possession of a firearm?
Yes.
A concealed deadly firearm? Yes.
Okay. So with that information, then there would have been a reasonable basis to do a search by the probation officials.
Without anything further, it might be a closer call than it is here. If the probation officer had simply come out and searched the vehicle, that might have been a closer call. But instead, the probation officer came out. He questioned his probationer, who, based on his experience, and as Mr. Letang noted, he had never had a problem with him. He expected him to answer the questions posed. He refused to do so. He was sweating and looked nervous. And had this been July, sweating might have been appropriate. However, it was February. He was sweating, and he looked nervous. He refused to answer the question. The probation officer was aware of his prior conduct involving firearms, specifically in vehicles, from a 1997 arrest for carrying a concealed deadly weapon.
Why would it be a close call if the facts were as they are stated in the record, but there was no questioning of the probationer?
I wouldn't suggest that it would be a close call, but a closer call. It would, to use a baseball metaphor, put the ball further in play than the state would submit that it already is. There it would be a little more difficult, perhaps, to prove that there was some independent investigation by the probation officer. And here, it's quite clear that there was an independent investigation, the extent of which is
the
reasonable.
The independent investigation consisting of the questions put to the probationer?
Certainly.
Yeah, he never contacted the complainant. He took, apparently, at face value, everything the police told him as true. That motivated him to confront the probationer.
Apparently, Your Honor.
Who's being confronted by someone who can act to revoke his probation and ultimately put him in jail and extraordinarily is sweating about that, even though it might be February. And that's the independent investigation?
The independent investigation would have been, the state would submit, knowing this person's history of firearms offenses.
Had one 10 years ago or 8 years ago?
8 years ago, approximately, for having a firearm in his vehicle. He had, and certainly the knowledge of this contributed to his concern. When he got out there, the state would submit that he's entitled to take what the police tell him into consideration and need not go speak to the complaining witness specifically. As Your Honor noted, it's certainly rational that Ms. Colazzo would call the police rather than probation and parole. And if the standard is we require complaining witnesses to call probation and parole to get a probation officer out there.
You're certainly correct about that. It would be unreasonable for us to expect people to know when someone else is on probation in every instance, and that the logical place to call for instant action is the police. What what I'd like to know is, do you have case law that suggests that this scenario of the police asking the probation officer to become involved before they complete their investigation because they have serious concerns about whether they could legitimately search the probationer's car, but have no concern that the probation officer could, if the probation officer chose to, search the car and thus avoid the annoyance of getting a warrant. Do you have case law that suggests that under those facts, this is not an unreasonable search and seizure as contemplated by either the federal or the state constitution?
I do not have specific case law on that point, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I do not have specific case law on that point. However, I would suggest that Miller is certainly a more egregious set of factual circumstances than what happened here, and the state would submit that this is virtually a model performance of how the system should operate.
But what is the I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
What is the rule of law that should apply in the circumstance when the police contact probation and parole and inform them about circumstances involving a probationer and this subsequent search by a probation officer happens? What is the rule that will make this case either good or bad and apply to future cases?
The state would submit that the rule should be as it is, that the probation officer may not simply be a stalking horse for the police, but rather must conduct some level of independent investigation to determine if reasonable suspicion exists to support the search.
And we're clear that the independent investigation here was taking everything the police told him to be true. He went to the location where his probationer was in a vehicle, and he asked the probationer if he had a gun in the car. And because the probationer couldn't answer it, and the heater in his car wasn't working, but he was sweating anyway, he determined he must be either potentially lying or just choosing not to answer the question because there in fact was a gun in the car, and then he searched the car and found the gun. That's his independent investigation.
That in addition to his prior knowledge of Mr. Everett's history of firearms offenses. Admittedly, they were fairly remote 8 years before, but nonetheless, given that the circumstances of the gun that they found in this case were quite similar to the gun that they found in the prior case.
And we should be comfortable that that does not constitute, under the Delaware Constitution, an unreasonable search and seizure without a warrant.
Certainly not, Your Honor. The court has no further questions. The state will rest on its brief.
The court's question about and one thing we have not discussed is the Department of Corrections protocol that is to be followed, and that was raised a couple of times. The item 4, which in some part relates to this, says as follows: searches should never be made solely on the basis of a request from law enforcement officials, but should be the decision of the officer. The time the phone call was made from the initial interview of this individual on the street to the office of probation and parole, the purpose of that phone call, as the officer said, was to get into the car because the individual on the street had not granted consent to have the car searched. There is nothing else in the protocol that has been established by the Department of Corrections, which it is an amorphous, very vague list of things to do other than check with your supervisor. And that is about the sum and substance of what their responsibility is. So they have a great deal of latitude as to what they want to do. There are cases where probation officers work in conjunction with the police when it's a combined effort. For example, we had used probation officers to assist police officers with photographs. And when the police are driving around certain communities of Wilmington, they had available to them, with the assistance of probation staff, photographs of people they could identify on the street to assist the officers. That is a combined operation, and I would submit to the court maybe some distinctions could be made if they're working in conjunction with one another in something like that. But in this particular case, the going back to the stalking horse kind of an argument, in this case, the probation staff here was simply asked or directed or suggested to come over because they wanted to get into the car, and they did that. The only information, as the court has pointed out, that they had about this situation, the only information that officer had was A, that the defendant on the street, or the person on the street, was his client as a probationer. Two, they wanted to get inside that car. Three, he was sweating. And the first words out of the office, or the probation officer's mouth, do you want to do this the hard way or the easy way? Putting himself someone in a position as a police officer. And when there was no response to that, the question was, is there a gun in the car? No response to that, and he went in and searched the vehicle. And
this probation officer, did he have all the information that the police conveyed to the supervisor?
I understand that he did. I understand that he had the information because there was some communication between the supervisors, and that was never explored. But I assume, as I said, Mr. Baker was an experienced probation officer, and I assume that he had received information from the supervisors. I don't think the record is clear on that, and again, I didn't have much part of making that record, but I'm not sure that was ever brought out. But we do know at the time that he got to the scene, he was apprised by the police as to what had transpired, as the Chief Justice had suggested. This is a shortcut in my opinion, and it is being utilized more and more. And I'm not sure that that is the intent that is not the position probation officers should be put in.
What is the rule of law that you are arguing for? If you concede that it's a reasonable search, what is the rule that we're going to announce in this case as you would like it to be?
The rule of law is that if the police are in a police mode investigation, it should stay as a police investigation. And to employ a probation officer simply to be an agent as a ruse is probably not appropriate, given the fact that they are circumventing constitutional protections that people have. And in this particular case, I think that is in fact what transpired.
So this is misconduct that requires suppression of evidence.
I think it's misconduct that requires suppression of evidence because the police have means at their disposal, and in this case, it was apparently established that there was sufficient probable cause by the judge listening to this. Why didn't they go get a warrant? And they chose not to because they wanted to take a shortcut instead of doing that. And the numbers of suppression issues that are now arising because of the employment of probation officers' involvement, the numbers have gone down. And if you're in Newcastle County, I don't know what the numbers of arrests are, and I don't know how many people arrested are on probation, but I would hazard a guess that the majority of arrests in Newcastle County, people are on probation. And that has a substantial impact on the process. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.